I cannot convey any better the traumatic words that you'd hear on this 911 tape. And when I hear them today, my blood runs cold.
911, what's your emergency?
I need an ambulance. My daughter's dying, I think.
Rescue is needed. 3-year-old female child, unconscious, not breathing.
It's Christina.
No! He is wasting away a life in a jail for a murder he didn't commit, and worse, for his own daughter, with whom he loved.
There is a whole bunch of evidence now that links Masuk to the crime scene.
There is absolutely no evidence of any forced entry, any breaking in, and according to the defendant, the only people in that house with permission were himself and Christina.
This is Suspect Convictions with investigative journalist and series creator Scott Reeder. I'm Willis Kern. The past several weeks, we've tried to untangle the mysterious events that led up to the tragic death of 3-year-old Christina McNeil, whose lifeless body was found by her father, Bart, in their Bloomington, Illinois apartment in June of 1998. And we've also checked into the murder conviction several years later of Bart's former girlfriend, Masuk. She was tabbed by Bart as the alternate suspect in the case, which found him sentenced in connection with Christina's death. We've heard recordings of 911 calls. We've heard from lawyers advocating for Bart's release. We've heard from current prosecutors. We've heard from crime scene experts, from true crime media reporters. We've heard from those who knew Bart and Masuk, and we've even heard from you, the Suspect Convictions listener. Today, we'll look back on the road we've traveled and try to peer into the future to see what might be ahead for Bart and McNeil, and if justice has been or will be truly served in the death of little Christina McNeil. Well, Scott Reeder, it's been a long haul. We've been going at this together now for about the last 7 or 8 months, working on this Suspect Conviction Season 2, and it's really been an interesting journey.
It sure has, Willis. I mean, we've uncovered a lot of information that I think will almost certainly be presented when motions are filed in court on Barton's behalf. It'll be interesting to see if that results in a change in how the case is handled. I mean, if it's compelling evidence for the judge to grant a new trial or to take other action. It's just frankly a very fascinating case to me. I've been a journalist for 30 years. You've been a journalist even longer than that. And I've never come across a case quite like Bart's. Have you?
No, not at all. It really has been something. And we'll go into detail a little bit more about some of those options that could unfold in the future as we go forward here, whether or not the Innocence Project decides to file motions and what could happen from there. But let's go back to the beginning of it all, the day that Bart McNeil found Christina dead in June of 1998 and picked up the phone and called 911.
To me, this is some of the most compelling audio I've ever listened to. And I've been doing this for a really long time. Why don't we have the listeners give it a listen, and then we'll talk about it afterwards.
I need an ambulance. I need it fast. 1106 North Evans. My daughter's dying, I think.
Okay, all right. Now, first, you got to help me out here now. Okay, calm yourself down. Okay. Now, how old is your daughter?
3, I think she's dead.
3 years old? Okay, all right, now hold on just a second now, and then I'm going to get to the rescue unit, and then I'm going to come back to the phone to get some additional information, okay? Does the color of her skin, is it blue?
No.
It's not blue? Okay, is she breathing?
No.
Okay, and she's 3 years old?
Yes.
Okay, all right, now stay on the phone with me, now don't hang up now, okay? Okay, hold on. Rescue is needed. 1106 North Evans Street. 3-year-old female child. Unconscious. Not breathing. Color of skin presently is unknown.
706 North Evans Street. 351 response. 351 responding.
Okay. All right, sir. She's 3 years old?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Do you have her in your arms?
No.
Okay. Is she near the phone with you?
Yes.
Okay. And is she breathing?
No.
She's not breathing at all. Okay. Okay, hold on just a second, sir. 1-1, that comes.
Christina! Christina!
Come here, guys.
One out of one. 1106 North Evans. 3-year-old child not breathing, unconscious. 3 North, 16th en route, if you can assist. 1106 North Evans. Okay, sir. All right. He is now unconscious. Okay, all right. And you can tell she's not breathing at all? Okay. What I need for you is let's put your child on her back.
She's on her back?
She's on her back? Okay, all right. Now, do not put your heel underneath her back.
217 is my area. You'll send that to me. I can respond.
Okay, now. Okay, what's your phone number there?
828-1873.
Okay, now that's fine. Okay, now what I want you to do then is put your, have her on her back, put your hand on her forehead, and then on the cheekbone, then tilt the head back. Okay?
Have the hands on the forward, cheekbone tilt the head back.
And tilt the head back a little bit there, okay? Alright. Okay, now you need to help me out now. You gotta keep yourself calm down here so you can help me. Okay, alright, now. I need to have you
start to slow.
Hold on here, let me see if I can tell Rescue what's going on here.
So, you know, Willis, two questions. One, does that sound like a guilty man or an innocent man?
Well, it sure sounds like an innocent man, and I can't imagine anybody, even the world's top prosecutor, listening to that and thinking that this man is exhibiting a kind of attitude that shows guilt at all. I mean, now he may be acting. Who knows? We've discussed this back in the first episode. But boy, I tell you, that is incredible audio that sure doesn't sound like acting to me.
I don't think Meryl Streep or Harrison Ford could pull off a performance like that. I mean, you listen to it. And I mean, we're both parents. I mean, my stomach is just clenching every time I listen to that. I'm like, this guy sounds absolutely frantic. He wants the police there now. He wants the ambulance there now. He is upset. I mean, it does not sound like somebody who's a cold, calculating murderer, a man who wanted to get rid of his daughter and now is putting on a show. I mean, it just doesn't sound that way to me. What are your thoughts, Willis?
No, I don't believe so at all either. And it's really interesting years later to look back at how the police handled this, not only the way they handled it in subsequent days or weeks, but how they handled it in that moment. And we've already talked a little bit about the way the police handled the way that he was reacting to things and the way he was acting on the phone. But there's been a little bit of confusion, I think, a little bit about the size of Bloomington. We're not just this sleepy little small town that never has a murder. I mean, there are a couple of two or three murders a year anyway in Bloomington Normal, and there were back 20 years ago. So, but the police still were not really expert in handling something like this, and I think this is probably exhibit A as to how they weren't.
Yeah, I mean, and some of the tapes that we're not going to play right now kind of made him look like Keystone Cops, I'll be honest with you. I mean, at one point, Bart kept calling back and calling back and calling back, trying to get a detective to come out later in the day after he found the cut screens to check things out, because he thought, he was convinced his daughter had been murdered. And he kept telling him that if you are a killer, the police come, think it's natural causes, and haul the body away. Would you keep calling the police back and insisting it was a murder? I mean, that doesn't seem like logical behavior to me. Now, not everybody behaves logically, but you listen to that and you go, wow, I mean, it just doesn't make sense. But then, okay, you listen to what the police are saying and what their attitude is. And we have a recording after he called several times, the police lieutenant in charge of the criminal investigation division says, well, what the hell is his problem? What do you mean? His daughter's dead. She died this morning. She thinks she was murdered. I mean, I think it's a pretty logical response from a father, if indeed his daughter was murdered, to want the police's undivided attention to investigate the case.
And of course, one thing I think we should make very clear to the listeners right now is that none of this audio was presented at his trial. None of this was presented to the judge who ultimately made the bench trial decision to convict Bart McNeil. He, as far as we know, never heard this audio, never heard Bart's what seems like a genuine cry for help.
That's my understanding. I mean, it just doesn't, it seems strange that this was stuff that wasn't considered in the trial itself. And, you know, the other thing that was strange in this case is that Bart was never given an opportunity in the trial to present Masuk as the alternate suspect. That was not allowed in. They said there just wasn't sufficient evidence, was the ruling, to point towards her. And here's the irony of it. This alternate suspect goes on several years later, after the trial, to kill somebody in a very methodical, planned, calculating way. Well, can't we step back and say, wait a minute here, maybe there was just a mistake here. Given in hindsight, this is something we should have considered. She is somebody capable of murder. Maybe we should have should be able to look at this and say, you know, that was maybe not the best ruling in the world to have made when you're presenting an alternate suspect who ultimately becomes a murderer.
And of course, as you mentioned, the key word there is hindsight.
Yeah.
We didn't know any of this back in 1999 when the trial was being held.
Easy to be a Monday morning quarterback on this stuff. I mean, you know, judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys are human beings. They go with the evidence that's before them, not with the evidence that might come down 5 or 6 years down the road. I mean, it's very easy to. But that's kind of the point of all this, is we're looking at this case with the eyes of looking back 20 years and what's happened in the time since. You know, we know more things now. And since we know more things, shouldn't we be applying that into the case to see if an injustice was done here?
Right. We have the luxury of knowing that Masuk Nolan went on to commit murder with some very strange similarities to a lot of the accusations that Bart was leveling at her in relation to Christina McNeil's death. One of the key aspects of this whole case is the fact that Bart noticed that the window had been broken into the night of the, or at least apparently the night that Christina died. And he noticed some tears in the screen. And we talked a little bit that in episode 2. But maybe you can set up a little bit for us, Scott, the testimony revolving around some spider webs in the corners of the window.
Yeah, first thing I'd say is, you know, what we do know is that the screen right above the latches to the window had been cut in a way that somebody could put their fingers in through the window and manipulate the latches to open it up. I don't think anybody's disputing that those cuts were there, or the question is, when were they there, and were they used that night? Now, when the prosecutors in the case, she said, well, you know, they could have been there 2 years before, or Bart might have used it months earlier to get into the house if he locked himself out. But, you know, so there's no guarantee that they were there the night, put in there the night of the murder. Bart, on the other hand, says they weren't there before, and that's why he kept calling the police and saying, get out here. I think somebody broke into the house. But one of the things that the prosecutors had concerns about was, with that story, is that there were spider webs across the screen. And they're saying, well, how could somebody have gotten in to the house if these spider webs were there? They would have broke the spider webs when they came through the window. And when the police got there, I don't know how many hours later, they found spider webs there. So it's like, is it possible that somebody could have come in if there were spider webs there? So we posed this question to a world-renowned entomologist at the University of Akron in Ohio. He examined the crime scene photos and everything else, and one of the questions we said is, you know, is it possible the spider wove a web in the time between when the window was last that morning and when the police got there? And so this is what Todd Blackledge, a professor at the University of Akron, had to say.
A spider builds a web that's perfectly capable of catching prey in a single night and can catch and consume small insects pretty rapidly. Now, that said, I did see some rather grainy video footage of the webs that the prosecution's talking about on the windowsill, and they did look like they were probably pretty old, but they also looked like they were a bit damaged. And at the end of the day, I couldn't ascertain from that video footage whether they were actually connected to the screen of the window that would have had to have been removed for somebody to come into the window, or if they were just connected to the frame around that screen.
What I'm hearing, Willis, when I listen to that expert is, yeah, the web could have been woven between the time that the murderer came in the window and the time the police eventually got there that night. And you got to remember, the police were dilly-dallying here, and they didn't get there until what could be as long as 24 hours after the alleged break-in took place. So, you know, a lot of things could have happened in that time frame in between. We don't know. You know, the other thing that ran through my mind is, let's say somebody did open up that screen. Well, they could have let a spider in when that happened. You know, we don't know. There's just a lot of questions there that are going to always remain questions.
Yeah, here's the way I look at this whole part of this case, is that it was pretty clear that prosecution at the time of the trial was trying to point out the fact that there is no way that this window could have been jerry-rigged that night or broken into that night because these spider webs were here. And I think what the defense is doing now, the Illinois Innocence Project, pointing out the fact that these bringing this expert, Todd Blackledge, to testify that, well, you know, I think that it raises enough doubt that it pretty much makes the whole thing moot to me. I mean, I don't think the window screen evidence really, as far as from the spider web standpoint, has much to do with the overall case, really.
I would agree with you on that. And I think we've all, at least I've had this experience, you know, I have some very persistent and spiders that inhabit the area around my front door. I constantly am battling these spiders with a broom. I sweep away their webs, and then a few hours later, I'll be walking through the door and I'll get caught up in a web. And it's like, how does that happen so quickly? Well, spiders operate quickly, and they spin their webs very fast. We know that from looking at the webs on this grainy video that the webs that were there, the old webs that were there, were damaged. We know that there was a web going across there, but the spider had perhaps as long as 24 hours to weave that web. I don't think that that's particularly damning evidence that it was there. Let's just put it that way.
I think the window scene is an important part of what happened here, and it could very well play a key role into whether or not Bart is released or granted a new trial. But I don't think the spider web aspect of the whole thing is going to be that much of a player in that particular part of it.
Let me ask you this, yeah, though, Willis, since we're talking about the window. One of the things that the prosecutors brought up is, you know, it'd take a pretty brazen person to come up to a window with the blinds down, cut holes in the screen, undo the latches, and slip into the room where somebody's sleeping. From what we know about Masuk, do you think that, in hindsight, that she might be capable of doing something like
yes,
that?
Yes, I think so. I think anybody but Masuk, I could say yes. That would be very brazen activity. But for Masuk, I don't think so, because of what she allegedly knew about Bart and about Christina, their habits, and particularly through phone calls from Bart anyway. Now, this is all going from Bart's side of it. Some of the discussions he had with her about what was going on that night, she had a pretty good idea of what was behind those closed curtains and what was behind those closed doors. So I think she knew the setup that she was going into. So I think that's viable.
The other thing that stands out, I mean, you know, we brought this up in the last episode for the first time, is that according to information given to us by her ex-husband, that night he got a call from Masuk asking him to get some pot to plant as evidence against Bart to frame him for drug possession. Now, it's interesting because her ex-husband has been her big supporter in this case and also has maintained that he thinks Bart's guilty, but he also says that Masuk contacted him that night and wanted him to get some drugs to plant on Bart. So we know, if we're to believe this, we know that it is in her character to try to frame Bart in some way for a crime because she's angry at him because he broke up with her that day. Is it such a stretch to believe that she could have manipulated this case to make it look like a murder? I don't know.
I think maybe it's not such a stretch. Really do. I really think it's not such a stretch. I'm not saying for sure, yes, that's what happened, but I think that that's raises considerable doubt.
Yes, it does.
In my mind, yeah. Let's go on now to another aspect of this whole thing, and that deals with how prosecutors are going to take this case if it does come up and go forward. And that is they're going to use the whole scenario that Christina was sexually abused, sexually molested by, according to them, Barton McNeil, who's serving a time in prison for her murder. And this all basically revolves a lot around the evidence regarding a vibrator that was brought into the case. Tell us a little bit about that.
Here's the bottom line. I mean, and what you hear from the prosecutors is you can't look at bits and pieces of all the evidence and debate them. You got to look at the cumulative evidence, which I agree with. One of the things that Bart was never charged with sexually abusing his daughter, but it kept getting brought up in the trial that it looked like Christina had been sexually abused. And what other man had access to Christina but her father? So it had to be Bart. Well, first of all, in the 20-some years since Bart's conviction, we have come to understand child abuse a little bit better. We know that both men and women can abuse their children. We know that Masuk has a history of abusing her children, not necessarily in a sexual way, but she has multiple DCFS reports and other evidence that she has been physically abusive to her children. There's some question marks have really risen up as far as what the initial pathologist has found is relevant science today. The original pathologist examined the body and found that the rectum had been dilated. That was interpreted at the time as being a sign of sexual abuse. Science has advanced. We now know that it's pretty normal for the rectum to dilate after a death because that's just part of the rigor mortis process. And I, from my interviews with the prosecutors, they kind of concede that, yeah, that we found that out since then. But they say there still was some swelling around the vulva, and that could be indicative of sexual abuse. Well, it could be. It's not unheard of, but as a parent, I know three-year-olds scratch themselves down there, and sometimes a yeast infection or something else can cause irritation in that area. And sometimes it can be just simple. You know, I've had changed diapers where there's swelling in that area because it just got irritated from a dirty diaper or whatever. I think Christina was no longer in diapers, but it can mean a lot of different things. But let's assume that the sex abuse took place. we know that Christina's hymen remained intact. So whatever would have been used in such a case would not have been something that would deeply penetrated her.
And there was no semen found.
There was no semen found whatsoever. That does not indicate that it was a man, or doesn't indicate if it was a woman for that matter. We just know there's no semen found, and there was irritation around the vulva that could have been caused by sexual contact there, or could have been something else. But we know that Bart, when he was confronted with the evidence that his daughter had been sexually abused, said, well, I wonder if Masuk used her vibrator on my daughter. And here's what Bart's cousin has to share about this.
All right, this is Chris Ross from San Diego, California, who was advocating for Bart's release, talking about the possible evidence of a vibrator in this case.
He told police this, and further, you know, told police that, you know, hey, if you put me in a room with Masuk, you know, I think I could get her to confess. And surprisingly, the police did just that. They took Bart upon his wish to confront Masuk and put them in the same room together the same day in which they're both being interviewed. This is the day after Christina's murder. And the first thing out of Bart's words are, you expletive molested my daughter, and you probably used one of your vibrators on her, didn't you?
This is a topic that really makes me uncomfortable, Willis.
Really, it's tough to discuss, but it's such a crucial part of what possibly happened that night.
Yeah, but here's the bottom line. Bart is making an accusation that Masuk is capable of abuse, physically abusing a child or sexually abusing a child. The question is, are those kind of allegations credible? Well, here's what Masuk's daughter had to say. A few months after Christina died, she had filed a DCFS report, a Department of Children and Family Services report was filed. And as an adult, this is what Michelle Nolan had to say about what her mother did.
She, you know, abused me a lot. If she got mad at my dad, or
such as, how would she abuse you?
Like a paper towel rolls. It's the wooden part. Nowadays they don't, you know, usually use them, but a really hard wooden stick. And, like, beat me, and times I would faint, you know, just black out.
And that was audio from the Bloomington Police Department, where they cross-examined Michelle about the possibility of her being abused by Masuk in her younger years.
So think about this, Willis. I mean, you have a few months after Christina dies, you have Masuk being accused of beating her own daughter with a dowel rod while she's laying on the bed. And the bed, allegedly, was the bed that Christina died on, that Masuk picked up at the Salvation Army after it was donated and had her own daughter sleep in it.
And again, this is all the stuff that we know hindsight after Bart was convicted in 1999.
So exactly.
When you think of all that has developed since 1999 that relates to the death of Christina McNeil and the possible suspects that could be involved, there's just question mark after question mark that gets raised.
And, of course, you know, we can't forget the biggest piece of evidence is Masuk went on to kill somebody. She killed her mother-in-law. She struck her and strangled her and dragged her body into a business she owned, hid the car all the way up in Chicago, but 3 hours away. She hid the body. She boxed up the body and hauled it away in an SUV and buried it in a park 90 miles away. I mean, there's a lot of methodical planning here. So she did all these things, but we're looking at just the elements of abuse that this woman's been accused of. And gosh, it sure does point to her being capable of doing something like this.
Well, Scott, if someone is just listening to this episode as their first introduction to what's been going on in this whole suspect conviction season, they got to be thinking, wow, why is this guy still in prison? Maybe you can state from the other side, why is Bart McNeil still in prison?
Well, the other side would say the cumulative evidence, you know. He was the only person home alone with his daughter that night. They're dismissive of the idea that somebody could have come in through the window. So basically, Bart was convicted based on proximity. He being the only person who would have had access to his daughter the night of the murder, if you discount the possibility somebody came in through the window. And they have been very dismissive of that possibility because, A, it would be a pretty brazen and thing to do. Well, we know Masuk can be pretty brazen. B, there were spider web across the window. So they think that that would be indicative that somebody couldn't have come through. Well, we know the spider web expert said, well, no, one could have gotten woven in that short a period of time without any problem at all. So it's coming down to, do you believe that it was possible that somebody could have come in through the window that night? And right now he's in prison because he was home alone with his daughter and she was murdered.
So that's where we are now. Bart McNeil remains in prison. Masuk Nolan remains in prison, both convicted of separate murders, more than a decade apart. So what happens now to Bart McNeil? What happens with the Christine McNeil death case, Scott?
Well, you know, early on, defense said that they were planning on filing motions in November. Well, obviously, that didn't happen.
November of 2017.
November of 2017. Right. That obviously didn't happen. They're saying they're being very meticulous and very careful and very thorough in preparing their motions that they're going to file in court. They're now saying it'll happen sometime soon. Well, soon is a rather vague term, and lawyers love vague terms. But I think we're going to see some motions filed. And I think there's no doubt about that. And when those motions are filed, they're going to be motions for a new trial to re-examine the case. And when those motions are filed, we're going to return to this case and discuss what's happening with it. And there'll be some future episodes on that. And on the podcast, suspectconvictions.com, we are going to be looking at some other cases of possible wrongful conviction. For example, next week we're going to be looking at the case of Daryl Parker, a Moline man, that was wrongly convicted in a 1954 murder in Lincoln, Nebraska, of killing his own wife. It's a fascinating case, and I think listeners are going to find it just absolutely riveting to listen to.
And again, that'll be next week at suspectconvictions.com, where you can hear that. Well, what about Barton McNeil? Where are we now, Scott? What do you think is bound to happen? What's your, if you're to gaze into a crystal ball, what would you say?
Well, I'm not clairvoyant, Willis, but I can tell you that I think that we're going to have some pretty interesting court appearances coming up here in McLean County. I think we're going to see some new evidence presented. I think it's going to be some compelling stuff from the defense. I think it's going to be a tough road to hoe anytime you try to overturn a conviction. I mean, it's extremely difficult. The law is set up to have finality of a judge or jury's verdict. But the things that have happened since the murder really raised some red flags to me that maybe an injustice was done in this case.
I tend to agree with you on that point. Whether or not legally that can be demonstrated going forward, I'm not sure. I have to admit that I am not an expert on criminal law and the nuances that could go into whether or not evidence can be allowed or what can be said in the future, what happened in the past, et cetera. I don't know where we can go here on that, but it seems to me that there is enough evidence that we've talked about here in the course of this season that certainly merits some reexamination. Now, technically, legally, whether that can happen, I guess just remains to be seen, I guess.
I think you're right, Willis.
It just makes you want to stay tuned for more, and that's what we're going to ask people to do. Stay tuned for more coming up later.
Sounds great, Willis. It's been terrific working with you, by the way.
You too, Scott. Thank you very much. Special thanks to Colin Thompson, WGLT General Manager R.C. McBride, and the production staff of Sound Ideas, including Mike McCurdy, Charlie Schlenker, and Ryan Denham. With investigative journalist and Suspect Convictions creator Scott Reeder, I'm Willis Kerr. Thanks for joining us during Suspect Convictions.